Blog Talk Radio.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Conan Amoros.
Hi, this is Carmen Amoros. Thank you for joining me today on the New York Podcasting Cafe. This is a program featuring celebrities, artists, actors, writers, authors, playwrights, public figures, and anybody who has anything educating and fun to contribute to the internet community. Thank you for joining me. Lieutenant Colonel David Bull Gerfein is a family man, a businessman, an artist, an actor. But most of all, he carries a badge of honor for having served as Lieutenant Colonel of the United States Marine. As candidate for New York's 4th Congressional District, David Gerfein's main focus is on national defense and security, economic growth and security, and honest leadership. As a U.S. Marine, David Gerfein was a leader who enlisted when he was just 17 years old, a Mustang who went from private to lieutenant in 25 years. With combat operations experience, he was an infantry officer who earned a Bronze Star for his service in Afghanistan, Iraq, the First Gulf War, Panama, Gitmo, Korea, and Africa. Gerfein graduated from Great Neck High School, an undefeated quarterback and artist. He studied at Syracuse University with a BS in political science and special commercial graphic design. He also attended Harvard, where he got an MBA and was class co-president. During his work as a congressional liaison, Gerfein met with Democrats and Republican members of Congress and staff and escorted them to Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries to improve their knowledge of national defense. A background actor, Gerfein appeared in the movies A Few Good Men. You might remember the scene where Jack Nicholson was restrained while screaming, "The truth! You can't handle the truth!" If you look closely, the Marine who restrained Jack Nicholson from attacking Tom Cruise with great authenticity in A Few Good Men, that Marine was David Bull Gerfein. Gerfein also guarded Kevin Spacey in House of Cards. Please join me in welcoming candidate for New York's 4th Congressional District, David Bull Gerfein. Good afternoon, David. Thank you for joining me on my program. How are you?
Hey, wonderful, Carmen. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm here with my wife, Beth, and we have actually our dog, Murphy, here as well. Very excited to be here.
That's fabulous. You know, you've come a long way from serving our country. First, you were a Harvard graduate, and you were in the military. Can you expand a little bit on your experience, the genesis of your career?
I originally enlisted in the Marine Corps when I was 17. Right out of high school. I actually signed up and left before my high school, or the day after my high school prom, and then became an officer in the Marine Corps, served in Panama, the first conflict, and then I was in the First Gulf War with one of the lead units going into Kuwait there, and then left active duty and went up to Harvard Business School, and I received my MBA up there, where I was also the class president. Came out, started working here in New York, and was starting a whole new career path when we were attacked on 9/11. And at that point, I decided to return to active duty before the Pentagon was even hit. I was in New York at the time and called up my old unit, returned to active duty, or requested to return to active duty. Went and served a year in Afghanistan, and then was one of the lead units into Iraq following that. And then served up on Capitol Hill for a few years. And then retired simply to be a father and focus on raising my young daughter, Avery. And somehow my little girl decided to grow up against my authorization, and she ended up seeing ISIS on TV and said, "Dad, you didn't get all the bad guys." So we were going to return to active duty when I talked to people who were on active duty in the Marines, including my nephew, and he's serving with the Special Operations Command, and he's focused on Boko Haram and some of the other threats there around the world. And he said, "You know, we're not doing what has to get done. The Marine Corps is downsizing, and the enemy is getting stronger. This has to be fixed at the highest levels." as such, I turned to my wife, who's here with me, and she's the smart one in the family. She's the MBA, CPA, risk analysis auditor. And I asked her, I said, what are we going to do? And so she said, well, let's go fix it. So we decided to run for office, and that's where we are right now. We're running for Congress, and we're getting a tremendous response out there. It's very exciting.
Now, I'm glad you answered the question I was about to ask you, and that was how Beth, made out with your involvement in politics and all of that. And it's just wonderful to have someone next to you who supports you all the way, and especially if she has. I saw her background, quite impressive young woman, very impressive. Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Daughter, I love your dog.
I couldn't do anything without the family support. It's, always family first, and I'm just blessed to have a very supportive and wonderful family.
Your dad, Arthur, was originally from Brooklyn.
That's right. As a matter of fact, a lot of people ask me about my family and, where I came, with this perspective on service. And my father, he was actually an NIT championship basketball player in New York, right as World War II was picking up. He had another focus in life, but he decided that it was time to serve as well. And he went and served as a United States Marine, and he fought throughout the Pacific and landed on Tinian, Saipan, and Okinawa. And what's interesting is, that probably would have been enough to motivate me to have a life of service. However, my mother, she also served, and she was actually a nurse during World War II who served in England.
You have quite an interesting family. Your mother's 90; she still plays tennis. That's quite
absolutely. As a matter of fact, my mother just dominated a recent 5K walk in the 91-year-old and over event. Now, she was the only person that actually participated at that age, but even still, we walked it together, and she did great. But my family, we believe in this concept that we refer to as noblesse oblige. Those who have the ability actually have the obligation to serve others. And as we've talked about before, my father, he was an NIT championship basketball captain of his basketball team in New York, LIU. He was out of Brooklyn, and the war came around, and he had a great, prosperous professional career or even a business career ahead of him, but he gave it all up to serve as a United States Marine during World War II. And he fought in Tinian, Saipan, he was on Guam, and also landed on Okinawa. And my mother, at that same time, she was a nurse in England during World War II. So both my family members, or both my parents, they understand the concept of service. And so for me, I just came by it naturally, and it was the, sort of the right path for me to go in.
So your mother wasn't British, though. Was she American, just serving in?
No, my mother was born in England. She was born in Lincolnshire, grew up in Nottingham.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. I see you have a British ancestry. How cool is that?
Absolutely.
You have come a long way from serving your country in the military to where you worked up the ranks as Colonel David the Bull Gerfein. And, of course, now you're running for congressional seat. Tell me, how did you get that name, Bull? How did that happen?
Well, it was mainly because I was very persistent and that, I was taught as a young Marine, you do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. You don't accept no as an answer, and you continue to press and to make sure that, you're looking out for others. And so as a young officer, as a young second lieutenant, we were down in Panama, and I was always leaning forward. And I was noted for my bold and audacious actions. And this major at the time, he identified it, and he nicknamed me Bull. He later became my battalion commander, and so the nickname stuck. And then he went on to become a general in the Marine Corps. And so pretty much everywhere I went, everybody sort of knew me as Bull Gerfein. And when I left active duty and I went up to Harvard, I thought, probably there I would shake it. But there were some people who had actually served in certain areas where I'd been before. And when I was introducing myself, they said, wait a second, you're Bull. I recognize you. I remember you. And so it stuck there. And needless to say, when I went to work on Wall Street for Goldman Sachs, they loved the concept of, the Bull moniker. So anywhere I've gone, it's pretty much followed me. And, it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere soon because most of my friends, they know me as Bull now.
You know, it's interesting. I worked for Goldman Sachs as a contract employee in technology. They treated us so well. Just wonderful to know that you work for such a great company. So you've done everything. You've served in the U.S. Marine. You're a businessman. You have congressional experience. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. One of my assignments while I was a United States Marine was actually serving up on Capitol Hill and spent a few years up there. And it was one of those assignments that I really wasn't all that excited about going to written initially, but it turned out to be an incredibly broadening and eye-opening experience that gave me insight into, you know, how our federal government works. And one of my responsibilities was to escort congressmen and senators overseas to actually see what was happening with regard to our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was representing at one time the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, General Jones. Another time I was the representative for a new Marine Special Operations Command that just stood up and was representing the Special Operations Command and MARSOC, the Marine Special Operations Command Unit. And it was great to be their representative. It was also great to interact with our civilian representatives. But I have to tell you that it was also very challenging because there was many times where we would show ground truth with regard to what was happening overseas, and then we would watch really horrible decisions being made back here at home, even though we knew that the representatives knew the truth. And it came down to a lot of politicians looking out for their own self-interests. And you know, I tend to joke and say that they're self-licking ice cream cones, that they exist to satisfy themselves as opposed to really making the right decisions for national defense. And that was a very frustrating part of what we would observe on the Hill.
And so while you were there, as you were seeing all of this, how far back was that?
Oh, let's see. That was probably around 2004 to 2008, right around there, or the end of 2007.
Not so long ago. That's not so long ago. The decisions that you saw that were being made, do you feel that they might have been reflective of the powers that be in the military or our country's administration, or is it a combination of things?
If we can step back, part of the frustration that I think our country's seeing is that the people who are placed into federal offices, our House of Representatives mainly, that they come from a background where they've been successful and they've gained name recognition as mayors or as assemblymen or legislators or in our case, in the district that we're looking at, a district attorney. Now, all of these people may have done very well in their local positions. However, when they're elevated into the federal government, it's not just a pay raise. That politics, it's not a career progression. It's about putting the right people into the right positions. And most of these people, they do not have the right experience, knowledge, resumes, or backgrounds to be making decisions about national defense or even large economic deals. And so this is where, when you have someone without national defense experience, they have to look to their parties and say, well, how are the Republicans voting? How are the Democrats voting? How do I need to vote to stay in office and to get reelected? And they're not making the best decisions for the nation. What ends up happening is party politics and self-interest actually takes precedence over national defense and what's in the best interest of our national economy. So when I was up there, I was able to see this firsthand, and it's really very disappointing. And this is where we've seen an incredible drop-off from post-World War II, where we had a significant amount of people who would actually serve our country in the national defense capacity, to where now if you look at the amount of people who have actually served our country in the armed forces, especially in recent conflicts, it's down to single digits. It's abysmal. And so it's not surprising that we're now making decisions to get engaged in certain conflicts that we should not, or that we're not getting engaged in other conflicts that we should, or that we're not engaging effectively. So these, when we ask, you know, is it reflective of the people? Is it reflective of the military? It has to be something that is the right decision for the nation and not necessarily what people think, but it has to be where, as a representative, you have to be a leader and a teacher, and you have to come out and you have to explain to people why certain things should be voted upon a certain way. But we don't have representatives that have that depth of knowledge that are capable of communicating that effectively.
One of the things that you mean is that they should have some background in either in military service or some knowledge, strategy, defending the country, a lot of
absolutely,
them.
Absolutely. And we really don't have that. That's what I intend to bring to the table is that I'm a United States Marine. I've served both active and reserve for over 25 years. I've seen four different conflicts. I was in Panama, the first Gulf War. I was in Afghanistan. I was in Iraq. I've seen decisions that have been made on the tactical, operational, strategic level. So I understand national defense, but I also bring a business perspective as a Harvard MBA who's run businesses, and I understand economic deals that should be focused on effectively. And these are really where we should be making decisions. We don't need people who are attorneys who, you know, attorneys argue, and they argue well, but they get paid whether they win or lose. Military people, if we don't make the right decisions, if we don't build the right teams, we die. Business people, if we don't build the right relationships, if we don't build the right we don't sign the right economic deals, we go bankrupt. So it's really imperative that we have the right people with the right motivation, the right background, the right incentives to be up there making the right decisions for our nation that will affect everyone in our nation.
For the folks out there who may not have a full grasp of what happens in the day-to-day life of a congressman, what will your work be like? Can you describe what you will be doing in that seat? A lot of people think that a congressman is somebody who goes on TV, shakes a lot of hands, attends a lot of meetings, but there's a lot more than that, isn't there?
The primary responsibility of our congressmen are to, and women, congressmen, congresswomen, it's to be looking out for the best interest of our nation. And again, of all the different levels of government, only the federal government has the responsibility for national defense, and that includes our congressmen, and that they have to be focusing on national defense. So the job certainly entails a lot of research. It involves attending a lot of briefings. When I was on the Hill, we would constantly be briefing congressmen and their staff. We would be taking them on what's called CODELs, congressional delegations, where we would fly them around the world so they would get greater insight with regard to what's going on. And ultimately, you must grasp as much information, and you have to be able to analyze this information so as to make the right decisions, which will then be turned into bills, which will eventually be voted upon and made into laws of our nation. And this is where there has to be an absorption process where people have to be able to absorb information quickly and effectively, but they also have to be able to quickly and effectively communicate that information to peers to make sure that we're building consensus and coalitions, but also to our constituents. And our constituents need to know what's happening, and so we're representing our constituents. So this certainly has to happen on a national defense level. It has to happen on an economic issue, but on a level. But there's also a component where we're voting upon budgets. The House of Representatives is responsible for holding the purse strings, and so we have to ensure that funding is coming back to support our district, make sure that we're trying to alleviate the tax burdens that we see on Long Island, which are really the highest in the nation. And being able to make sure that we're focusing on doing the right things for everybody back in our district, as well as making decisions for the nation as a whole.
What is it that you hope to crusade against? And do you feel that partisanship is more important, or is problem solving the key focus of your goals?
No, I don't think partisanship is ever the right answer. And this is where, again, as a United States Marine working overseas, I've worked with combined joint coalitions of international forces where we've had to work with various different groups, and moreover, I've interacted with local tribe members and interacted with people on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq, and being able to understand and have empathy for various different organizations and try to figure out what's in everybody's best interest while making sure that at the end of the day, the United States interests are being focused on effectively. That's of primary importance. And Carmen, one of the biggest challenges we have right now is that the people that we're putting up into the federal government, they really don't have the experience, background, knowledge, or resume to be serving at the federal level. Most of these people, where they come from is they've served as local officials, whether they be mayors or assemblymen or legislators at a local level, or in this case, in the 4th District, as a district attorney. And so what ends up happening is when they get up into the federal realm, this is a very different level from local politics or even state politics, that they really don't have the background or experience to make the right decisions. So when it comes to national defense, they end up looking to their left and right and saying, well, how are the Republicans voting? How are the Democrats voting? And so this is what breeds this partisanship. This is what breeds the parties taking precedence over national defense or over national interest, because they don't have the ability to stand up and say, well, wait a second, I've been there, and what you're proposing doesn't make sense. And this is where we bring a very different background. As a United States Marine who served 25 years, I'm able to come up and I can point to specific examples on the ground as to why proposals may or may not work. And I can speak with confidence, I can speak with authority, and I can speak from firsthand experience. And this is something that we're lacking right now up on Capitol Hill. So this allows us to build consensus because it's based upon fact as opposed to based upon really party politics.
Clearly, you have plans for when you finally hold New York Congressional District number 4 seat. How will your work differ from that of your opponent?
Well, many of the things we've discussed already, the experience I bring to the table is very different. My opponent, Kathleen Rice, from everything I've heard, you know, she's been a district attorney and she's done her job well. Obviously, there's some people that feel differently about certain things that she's done, but I'm not going to critique her role as a district attorney. The difference is that what we're asking for somebody, not as a New York State senator, but as a federal representative in the House of Representatives at the only level of government that focuses on national defense, is bring some national defense experience to the table. And she doesn't have that. The other thing is we're making large economic decisions. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a huge deal that's going through right now that we're talking about economic issues that are going to impact our country in a large economic way, and she has no business experience. So the major issues that my opponent has been having to address, she hasn't been able to do it with her own personal experience, her own personal knowledge, her own personal education. So this is the difference. So we've seen this, you know, most recently with regard to votes about releasing terrorists from Guantanamo Bay. She's voted to release them and to bring them into the United States. We've seen this with regard to funding Iran and releasing the $150 billion, which both the leadership in Iran and our own president has said, yes, some of that money will go towards supporting terrorism. This is simply not acceptable. So these are the type of things where putting the right people in the right positions to make the right decisions is absolutely in our nation's best interest. And this is where I differentiate from Kathleen Rice.
You've made your point, especially, you know, with regards to national security. That's where it's important for people to have the kind of background that you are bringing to the table that will let other people know, hey, this guy, he knows what he's talking about. He's been everywhere. He's done this. He's been in the front lines.
I have. I've been one of the lead Marines into many conflicts, terrorism. It exists. The sad thing is that the people who are catching the brunt of it throughout the world are actually the Muslims. 30,000 Muslims a year die at the hands of violent Islamist supremacists. And for us to not identify the enemy as the enemy, we're actually doing a disservice to the majority of Muslims throughout the world. And we need to stand up. We need to take a leadership role. And we need to face this and confront it head on, not simply for the United States, not simply for our allies, but for all citizens in the world. And to allow something like this to spread, it's horrific. And we've seen what happens when the United States doesn't take a leadership role, that evil ideologies spread and people die. And to say, well, it's not our responsibility. Well, if not us, then who? There is no other power like the United States. We are a unique country, and we do stand up for other people. We do stand up to support freedom-loving people throughout the world. And this is our unique role that we play. And to step back from that, there's a terrible disservice to our country as well as the rest of the world.
Do you think of the problems with our existing culture and law enforcement and the resulting riots that have occurred in North Carolina? What do you feel needs to happen to help improve cultural harmony across our nation? How would you be helping to address and solve these problems?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to look at the facts. It's very easy to get emotional and to be upset when we see one of our own citizens getting harmed, and rightfully so. But we have to make sure that we're looking at really what the causes are and if this is a systemic issue or whether these are specific issues. And we have to look at these things rationally. And this is where
I think that we've seen a lot of people, they're spinning a lot of the information into something that truly is not the case. And when you break it down and you look at the numbers and you look at the statistics, you find that a lot of the discontent is being perpetuated, you know, when you want to talk about myths, on misinformation. And that's harmful to our country, because at the end of the day, we need to unify. And we see politicians who like to separate and segregate based upon skin color. And the sad reality is that regardless of whether we have different or same skin color, we're not the same. We're not the same just because we have the same skin color, and we're not different because we have different skin color. We have people that come here to the United States who are extremely successful, regardless of their skin color. And we have other people who are not as successful, and it's not based upon skin color. And there are people who are criminals who are of all ethnic background, and we need to be able to identify people based upon the content of their character. That was said by Martin Luther King. He talked about having a dream of us all living together, united, and focusing on harmony and peace and love, and not separating based upon skin color. And unfortunately, we see that more and more politicians, they want to do that. And again, it's not healthy. It's not in the best interest of our nation. And we have to be able to step forward and do the right things across the board.
I always saw from past presidents that it was the president who was the unifying force, someone who stood up for peace, someone who brought everyone together.
But if we're talking about international issues and we're talking about issues of terrorism, that's one thing. If we're talking about internally within the United States, I think that's something different. And I think the president certainly does play a role in all of these matters. I think that all leaders in our country play a role. If we want to talk about internationally, when we're talking about the president of the United States being a unifier, certainly, but we unify against our enemies. And remember, our founding fathers, including George Washington, who was the president at the time, he wasn't someone who was looking to unify with England. He was looking to separate from a dictator, King George. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, our Declaration of Independence, this was not a unifying measure at all. This was absolutely standing against the dictator and saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're going to have our freedoms. We are going to have our rights. And this is where, from there, it led to our own Constitution and the establishment of the federal government. And then from there, it led to our Bill of Rights. But please understand, our founding fathers went to war for our freedom. Abraham Lincoln went to war to end slavery and then to ultimately to unify our country. Eisenhower, he was a general. He was a great general that led warriors and then came back here and was instrumental in unifying our country with civil rights. So our presidents play many, they wear many different hats, but I think it's a naive perception that a president should simply appease people. And where we've seen this, most dramatically was Neville Chamberlain, who appeased Hitler and the Nazis. And he came back and saying, yes, we have peace in our time, as he allowed Poland to be invaded and Czechoslovakia and allowed Europe to fall under the belief that, look, we're all going to get along now. And that was a horrible play by a leader. And it took Winston Churchill stepping in and then ultimately the United States and the Allies coming to the support of England to stand against Nazis. So no leader of our country should be in favor of war. War is a horrible thing. I'm telling you, having been there, it's horrible. However, there are things worse than war. Unbridled aggression is worse than war. The loss of freedom is worse. And there are things that are worth fighting for, such as our families and our future generations and the ideals that our country has established and that we help to foster throughout the world. So I think that certain people feel that we should just be making friends everywhere, and certainly we should with those that want to live in a peaceful, tolerant way. But those who choose not to, they have to understand that we're not going to tolerate intolerance.
What's your stance on the state of Israel? What's your feeling about Israel?
Well, to start with, I have personal feelings about Israel in that I have family that live there. So for me, I have very strong personal convictions. But from a professional standpoint, this is an ally. This is one of the strongest allies we have in the region. Other than Iraq, it's the only other democracy in the region. So to look at it from any other standpoint doesn't make any sense. That we need to be unifying with this country, as we always have. We need to stand firm with this country. We hear a lot of propaganda coming out about the Palestinians. And again, most people don't understand the history. And to take into account of where Israel was founded, people say, well, this used to be Palestinian land, and there's various different perspectives on this. And the one argument would say, well, it really wasn't Palestinian land, that it may have been Jordanian, Syrian, or Egyptian land. And if we're going to start giving land back, well then why don't we start by giving California back to Mexico? You know, at what point are we going to start the clock?
And Texas.
And Texas, exactly. So we arbitrarily, we put a very different standard on Israel. And to try to pretend that it's not anti-Semitic, there is no other explanation for it. It really doesn't make sense. Again, Israel is an incredible democracy. It provides unbelievable equal rights for women. Their level of participation within the military and throughout every aspect of their commerce and politics, and even the involvement of the Arabs who live in Israel, who are in the Knesset, they're voting members. It's a fully integrated country. And then for the United Nations to come out and condemn it as having some of the worst civil rights violations, really? Compared to all of the other countries that are out here in the world and the women's rights violations, it's unfathomable that they would be chosen out of these other countries where the abuses against women or people in general are so blatant. So, Beth, you had something you want to say?
And actually, the freest Arabs and Muslims in the Middle East live in Israel.
Absolutely. Great point.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things people don't realize. And so, time and again, you know, with the Palestinian situation, we've said, okay, well, let's try and set up something that will work. And so we pumped the largest amount of per capita money into Gaza. We said, here, here's money. Let's try and set up some successful areas. And the money went directly into building tunnels under Israel to infiltrate and to build armament and to develop rocket systems to fire into Israel. So there really isn't a peace partner that's looking to live in coexistence. And this is very challenging because the narrative gets very skewed. And it's very disappointing when we see what's happening. And it's even more disappointing when we see the United States not being involved and not working to support Israel.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Conan Amoros.
Jumping back to the United States, the fight on drugs, drunk driving, and what are your views on that?
On Long Island, the heroin epidemic it's horrible, and it's claiming many young lives that really we need to be focusing on, and our law enforcement's doing a great job. We have to continue to support them and give them the means to be successful. There's many different ways of addressing this. Now, one of the biggest issues that we have is that we've got very porous borders, and it's very easy for both illegal immigrants to come into our country as well as the passage of drugs. And, you know, the war on drugs is going to be very tough, and it has been very tough, and it's been proven that it's one of those things that it's an ongoing effort for law enforcement. But we make it harder when we have such a porous border. National defense includes border security, and there are many different issues that we'll be focusing on, but there's a differentiation, and our Constitution is very clear with regard to matters that the federal government is supposed to be involved in, and anything that's not mentioned in the Constitution, that's supposed to belong to the states and the local governments. They're supposed to be focusing on that.
What about gun laws? Is that something also that's part of all of that?
You know, people are concerned about guns, and we have to look at what exactly the problems are and if the problems really are guns. And so I think that if we looked at the United States, would we be able to say, all right, let's find the state? And again, there's different ways of looking at the gun situation. We could look at it from the Second Amendment and the reason that we do have the right to bear arms, and it was out of concern for a tyrannical government. That was why our founding fathers established it, because as we were establishing our federal government, we were concerned, because history has shown that federal governments or large overarching governments tend to move towards dictatorships and then the limitation of rights. And this is why the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment. It's not the 27th Amendment, like you should be allowed to hunt a squirrel. It's right after the First. which gives us all our rights, then the Second Amendment says yes, and we will not infringe upon people's ability to bear arms. And it's very important to understand that that's why we have the right to own weapons and guns in our country. And our founding fathers felt that was extremely important, and they backed it up in the Federalist Papers when they talk about the ownership of weapons. So that's one aspect. The second aspect that people are very concerned about is crimes that are being committed by guns. And so for some reason, whenever there is a crime committed by a gun, the immediate response is, well, let's remove the guns. And we don't say that when there's car accidents. We don't say, well, let's remove the cars. And because we realize that automobiles, they have an important role in our society, just as guns have an important role in our society. Again, if we want to take it to the highest level against the possibility of tyranny by the government, which, again, we're not talking about the Obama administration or Trump or Clinton administration that will come in next. It may not be for the next 20, 30 years, but at some point, if we no longer have guns, then it's too late when all of a sudden there's a tyrannical government that says, you know what, anybody of this certain religion, guess what, we're going to exterminate you. It's too late then to say, well, now I want my guns back. So this is why we do have the gun ownership. But we then have to look at the violence and the crime, and we say, well, what's going on here? And I think we would agree if we looked at all the different states and we said, okay, let's find the state that has the lowest murder rate caused by guns, and whatever gun laws they have, let's implement them throughout the entire United States. That would seem like a rational thing to do, wouldn't it? When we look at that, we find that Vermont has the lowest murder rate by guns. And when we look at their gun laws, we find they have none. And then when we find the second state that has the second lowest amount of murders by guns, it's New Hampshire. And we look at their gun laws, they have none. So obviously there's something else besides guns and gun laws, because law-abiding citizens are not the ones committing the crimes. Law-abiding citizens have more guns out here than the crimes that are being committed, because if it really were just the gun, then obviously we would be having a lot more murders, and we don't. And so there has to be something else here. And the reality is, if we looked at a few major cities in the United States, and say Chicago, where we just had 3,000 gun incidents just this year, we've had thousands of young men and women being killed, innocent people too, in Chicago. We look at Detroit, we look at Baltimore, we look at Washington, D.C., we look at New Orleans. If we took these few major cities out of the equation, we wouldn't have what's being perceived as this epidemic of violence due to guns. So if that's the case, just as, you know, if you had a toothache, I wouldn't be examining your feet. I would say, let's look at the tooth. So in this case, why wouldn't we look at specifically where we have a problem, not looking at the entire United States and saying we have a problem? And it seems like, well, it is. It's the politically expedient thing to do. All of a sudden, there's a gun shooting. Get the guns out of there. And everybody seems to cheer because the politicians are doing something. And the politicians tried doing something here in New York. They did the SAFE Act. But when you read the SAFE Act, you realize that a vast majority of what was written was trying to outlaw weapons based upon purely cosmetics, on aesthetics, the way the weapon looked. And they tried to classify these things as assault weapons. And it was an assault weapon if it had a pistol grip or if it had a bayonet lug or if it was, you know, made of a certain material. But the exact same weapon that had a wooden stock was not illegal. And so it really was one of these things that the politicians were able to say, look, we've done something. But this is where we have to get away from the politicians saying, look, I've done something, and saying, look, we're doing the right things. And so the right things really are looking at the criminals who are committing these crimes and saying, if you're involved in any sort of criminal activity and you're carrying a gun, you're going away for a significant period of time. And now all of a sudden you're going to stop the criminals from carrying guns because they're going to realize the risk is too great for them to even carry the gun. And this is the problem where the risk is not. And we see the recidivism, and we see that people with guns are being given very light sentences. And so this is why when we had mayors in New York that were Republican under Koch, and we had Bloomberg following out that it was very tough on crime and guns, that we saw the murder rates going down. Well, now under de Blasio, where all of a sudden we're seeing a leniency, we're seeing rape and murder and violent crimes going up. And so maybe, again, it's not the guns. It's the criminals, and it's the activities and how we're addressing those activities.
Mm-hmm.
The other big issues are that we've seen liberal democratic policies in these major cities that I just mentioned that perpetuate the violence because they're putting in economic systems that are not helping the cities. And so there's, again, this sort of an environment that is not facilitating success. It's not
right.
allowing more choice. It's not allowing for people to get out of these challenging environments. And so
right.
there's a propensity to turn towards violence and crime. And you can have the strictest gun laws in the world, but if the criminals still have access to guns, it doesn't matter because the only people that are abiding by the laws are the law-abiding citizens.
True. It's when they get in the wrong hands. Of course, people need to have a right to protect themselves. And I think that's important.
And here's the thing. They want to make it tougher on people to own guns. The areas that they're addressing are the places where a lot of people, they're living in hellish environments. And the law-abiding citizens must be allowed the ability to protect themselves because, unfortunately, our law enforcement simply do not have the ability to respond quick enough. And this is where I've had this conversation with people before, where they say, well, I would never want to have a gun in my house. And
mm-hmm.
and that's understandable. I don't want to have guns in my house. I wish we could remove all guns from our society. But that's just, unfortunately, not reality. So the next question is, would you rather have a gun and not use it, or be in a situation where all of a sudden your family is endangered and you don't have the ability to protect them? You
mm-hmm.
don't have the ability to stop who's ever perpetuating whatever horrific crime against your wife and daughter. And for me,
mm-hmm.
that would be horrific, to not be able to stop a crime by somebody who does have a gun. A
couple of years ago in our neighborhood, there was a break-in, and the parents were in another room, and perps broke into the house. The son, the little boy, I think he might have been about 9 years old or 10 years old, ran upstairs, found the gun, came back down, and he shot one of the perps, and he was able to stop what was happening. I'm not saying that a child should have their hands on a gun, but they are living. They're alive now because of a gun.
Those are the stories that don't get told, is, you know, how many lives have been lost out of self-defense that, you know, they took the life of a criminal. Those stories don't get told. And most of the people that have an aversion to guns, they've never handled a gun before, and they tend to be scared of a gun. And I'll tell you, listen, the thought of driving on a highway where people are going, you know, in excess of 65 miles an hour in opposite directions, I mean, that could be pretty scary because anybody could just
scary.
Cut across there and kill you.
That's right.
But we don't.
I was thinking about that last night. I was
right.
thinking about that last night as I was driving home, and suddenly it dawned on me, oh, my God, I'm so vulnerable. Somebody on the other side can come straight at me. There's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do.
That's right. What about the individual that just says, you know what? I want to kill you, and then drives across the median. Well, that could happen too, but it doesn't. And that's the thing, that taking another person's life, this is not a natural act. And so we do allow people the ability to drive automobiles at high rates of speed. And the reality is that certainly we do have accidents, and there are dangerous situations, but very, very few are intentional. People are not intentionally killing people, nor are law-abiding citizens who are carrying weapons. You know, this comes to the next issue where people talk about, well, what about the mass murders? Well, and the mass murders are horrific. And to be clear, the loss of one life is horrible, especially at the hands of somebody who's mentally unstable. And we've seen this time and again. And what most people don't realize is that the person who intends to commit a mass murder, almost invariably, they don't wake up that day and say, you know what, I'm a little bored today. I think I'll go down and start shooting people. It just doesn't happen. They actually plan out their attacks, and they figure out, where can I do the most amount of devastation before I'll get stopped? And what's interesting is the places that they pick are gun-free zones. Why? Because they know that there's nobody's going to shoot back. And so, like in Aurora in Colorado, the shooter could have selected any movie theater to attack, but they chose the one that was a gun-free zone where there was no armed security, because they realized that they could do the greatest amount of damage without being harmed. And so this is where the threat of some violence coming back towards a perpetrator of a crime is really a very great deterrent. And you know this because when you talk to criminals that are in prison. These individuals, they're not heroic. They don't intend to go into a gunfight and see themselves as being some glorious warriors. They want to commit a crime and get away with it. So when they know that they're going up against somebody who may have a weapon, they're going to choose some other potential victim that's not carrying a weapon, because they don't want to get into a fight. They want to commit the crime. Their ultimate goal is to commit the crime, and whether that be taking other people's lives, whether it be raping someone, whether it be robbing someone, they want to do it with as little resistance as possible.
I was actually in a heist. I was in a store shopping for food, and five men came in with guns. One pointed a gun directly at my face. I was looking down at the barrel of what was then a Saturday Night Special. And,
oh, my gosh. Horrible.
And they ushered us to the back, and they ordered us to get in the freezer and lie down. Of course, we didn't go in the freezer. We stayed outside, and we didn't lie down. Everybody sort of squatted where they were. And the owner had a gun, and he said, "I have a gun behind such and such." And I said, I'm clamping down, and I'm holding on to him. And I said, "Not now, please," because I had little brothers in the store. But as soon as the men started to make their way out of the store, he darted for his gun, and he shot one of the guys. Had he not had a gun, they would have been right back, and it would have done the same thing all over again. And who knows what else they would have done, and to whom, you know, you just don't know. So it has to stop somewhere.
Absolutely.
Stop somewhere.
Absolutely.
I see on the website, Bull Can Handle the Truth. What's that all about?
Well, you know, it's funny. We go around to fairs and different events, and, you know, I introduce myself, and people, you know, they're interested that I've served as a United States Marine, and they're interested that I have a Harvard MBA. But the only thing that they really care about, or at least the only thing that gets any sort of a major response, is mm-hmm. that I was in the movie A Few Good Men.
Oh,
and that's where,
really?
When people realize that I was actually in the courtroom scene and held Jack Nicholson back from attacking Tom Cruise, then all of a sudden people are like, oh.
Oh,
and all of a sudden,
I see the photo. I see the photo. Wow.
Yep. Absolutely.
That's huge.
Yep, it was a fun experience. I was on the set for about 28 days, and we shot it over and over again, and was able to meet Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise and Demi Moore and Kevin Bacon and Kiefer Sutherland, and it was an incredible set. There was a lot of people there, and for the most part, you know, everybody, you know, really very engaging and wonderful people.
I also happen to hear your name in the media, if the Gulf War and then Afghanistan and all of that. There are so many articles out there about you in the New York Times, and anybody who really wants to read up on you can find a whole bunch of articles about your work, you know, before you retired. And then, of course, now you run for the congressional seat. So you're quite a high profile person. I'm kind of lucky that I have you on my program.
I don't know about that. Listen, I think we're just fortunate that it was, you know, coincidence. We met out, and you have an amazing personality, and you're very warm, and I'm just fortunate to be here and being able to spend some time with you.
And I am just honored to have you on this program.
I'll let Beth talk about her involvement in the campaign and her perspective on all this.
Great.
So I would just say that I think David running for Congress is, you know, obviously very exciting for our family and for him, and it's just a great opportunity for us to be involved and help support and guide our country. But mm-hmm. I think that he has just such a great background and personality for it that, you know, I can't even think of anyone. I mean, obviously I'm biased, but can't think of a better background and personality for a job like this. You know, as he's mentioned several times in this conversation, his experiences within the Marine Corps and, you know, having seen the execution of our foreign policy firsthand gives him mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of insight into things that are going on right now overseas in some of the same places that he has served. And then on the, you know, business and economic front, having understood the background of businesses, what drives business owners and business interactions, deals, taxes, and those types of things. Those are two of the critical areas that our leaders nationally need to have insight on. So
yes.
You know, those two things, I think, give them a tremendous amount of insight into those critical issues. And then with his personality being one of inclusiveness and, you know, warmth and just being a great dad to his daughter Avery and to, you know, all of her friends that are always over here, and a great husband, and, you know, all of my friends always enjoy meeting him. You know, it's just, he has that personality where he can work with anyone and, you know, respectfully disagree if necessary, but, you know, have that conversation based on facts, because so often we're not talking about facts, we're talking about feelings and myths and someone's spin on things, and he really does a good job of getting people back to the facts. And we can disagree on what to do about things, but we need to be able to agree on the facts. And I think he does a really good job of that, and I think our government needs more of that as well. So I'm tremendously excited and supportive of him doing this. You know, obviously he's the apple of my eye, but I'm super excited. It's a crazy undertaking, but, you know, we're completely new to this, but I think it's great, and I think it's the right thing at the right time for New York and for our country.
The more I read about his history, his bio, and everything, I'm beginning to wonder if he shouldn't be running for president.
We've heard that one for out on the trail. So.
How can you say that with such great presidential candidates right now? Well, look, the reality is right now I'm focusing on this position and I want to do this job well. Mm-hmm. And that's where our focus of effort is. And I think that anybody serving anywhere for our government should be, you know, look, this goes back to my father's perspective. Whatever job you do, do well. And it's an old Latin saying, "Age quod agis." What you do, do well, so wherever you are. And you know, this is it leads to respect. And we've seen people at every different station in life, whatever job they're doing, whether it be someone working behind a counter at a retail store or the president of the United States, just do your job well. That's how you earn respect. And so we intend to do our job well here, and we're going to continue to focus on serving people. That's the most important thing.
All eyes are going to be on you in November. And
Absolutely. Hopefully
my husband and I get the opportunity to see you and Beth singing a song of triumph and celebrating with Avery. And I really hope that this country gets what it really deserves. We need a few good men.
And women as well.
I will certainly keep my eyes out and be of great support. We're going to be sort of waving you on and celebrating and trying to do everything that we can to bring some money, get people to donate at your website. It's GerfineForAmerica.com website. I would like people to consider going there and looking at the donation section of the menu. Read up on David Gerfine. His bio is there, his positions, everything that he's about. He's an artist too. You're an artist also, right?
That's correct. Yep. I inherited some amazing skills from my mother as well.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, there's just so much information there that I'm urging folks to go and check out, all about this wonderful man with this wonderful family who is running for this very important seat. Please vote for him. I'm appealing to the audience to please go out and vote for him and dig into your pockets. Coordinate some dinners and some events and help raise some funding for this campaign. Really get out there and join him and his campaign manager and his people. If you also want to make a call to the office, the number for Gerfine for America is 516-387-2039. And you're also available, or you can be found on Facebook and all of the social networks, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My own personal, but we've got a campaign Facebook page at Gerfine for Congress, and we have over 5,500 likes on our page already. It's only been up a few months. We're really gaining a lot of traction. It's wonderful.
What about those people who are undecided about voting for the President of the United States?
You know, Carmen, I'll tell you that right now we have people who, you know, some people, they love Hillary. Other people love Trump. But there is really a tremendous amount of people who really dislike both candidates, and are concerned, they're gravely concerned about either candidate being elected president. And they've turned to me, and this from both sides of the aisle, from both Republicans, Democrats, independents as well, who've said, we are not going to vote for the president because we just don't like either candidate. However, we will vote for you because we understand how important it is that we have someone in the House of Representatives who will speak truth to power, who will maintain a rational disposition, and who will make sure that we're guiding our leaders along the right path. And so I'm very honored that people will turn to me and expect that of myself and other people that we're putting into the House of Representatives. And again, regardless of whether or not they come out to vote for the president, it's important that we get people involved in the whole democratic process. So it's truly been an honor with all of the people that I've met so far.
I am undecided myself, but you know what? I'm a faith-based person. I grew up in a very strong faith-based household, and whoever wins, wins. They're going to be our president, and we have to respect them, and we have to pray for them, and we have to ask God to guide them in leading our country. And hopefully we will all decide to exercise our right to vote, get out, and just pick a candidate. You know, and I hope that from having talked to you, having met you, people will be inspired, and I'm sure that they are, many of them have, to go out and vote for the president of the United States of America.
If you don't get involved, if you don't vote, then you're basically, you're giving up your ability to influence your future, and you're allowing other people to decide your future for you. And this is one of the things that we as Americans, we don't do. We take action, and it may not be the exact action that we like, but it's better than taking no action. We have to move forward, and we move forward confidently. But we weren't given that right. We fought for that right. And that's something that people have to remember, is that we've fought for everything that we had right now. And these are our inalienable rights that we had. Our founding fathers, they drew a line in the sand, and they said it's not just about living. It's about living as free people. Now, granted, it took a while for our country to work through a lot of the challenges that we faced. And even some of our founding fathers had challenges with the Constitution because they recognized that not all men were free at the time. Not all people were free at the time. But where people can't lose sight of is that this is a work in progress. We're a very young country, and it's all about continuous improvement. And the ideals upon which this country are built are like no other. And this country and these ideals must continue. And we must survive. And we must improve. And we must unify internally. We must be one country, one team, united as one America. Because this is the way that we will be able to shed light on the rest of the world.
Thank you so much for being on my program. I really thank you, David Gerfine and Beth, for joining me on this interview with the New York Podcasting Cafe. It's really, really been an honor to have you here today.
Thank you so much. And anybody who wants to learn more about our campaign, please, you can follow us on Facebook, or you can go to our website at www.gerfineforamerica.com. That's G-U-R-F, as in Frank, E-I-N, as in November, foramerica.com. And certainly, you know, part of the biggest challenges we have right now is raising money so we can raise awareness. So anybody who's feeling like donating to our campaign, we would be honored, and we would obviously respect everybody's ability to give at any level. It's imperative that we raise the money so we can do the advertising and let people know there's an alternative to lifetime politicians. And I would say, don't just support me, but if you know of others who are coming in, who are outsiders, they really need the financial support to make sure that we win these races and we bring the government back to being of, by, and for the people.
David and Beth, I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much.
You.
It's really been wonderful.
Great talking to you.
Thank you. Thank
All right,
you
have a great that. Night.
Thank you, you too.
You have been listening to an interview with U.S. Marine retired Lieutenant Colonel David Bull Gerfine and Carmen Amoros Goldberg on the New York Podcasting Cafe. Thank you for joining me. And look for David Gerfine on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social networks. If you would like to organize fundraiser events on behalf of the David Bull-Gurfein campaign for New York's 4th congressional seat, please contact him at www.gurfeinforamerica.com. His telephone number there is 516-387-2039. You can also write him at P.O. Box number 42, Nassau County, New York, 11030. Thank you for joining us. See you soon.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Carmen Amoros.